Professor Ryrie, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for inviting
me. My pleasure. So can you tell us about yourself and your work, please?
Sure. Well, I mean, I'm a historian of Christianity. I teach nowadays in the Department of Theology and Religion at Durham University. I don't actually have any qualifications as a theologian to speak of. I'm a historian by training, and I used to teach in a history department before I came here. And it felt like a slightly risky move at the time, coming sort of over the wall into a different discipline. But I did that 13, 14 years ago, and it's been great. Not just because Durham's a great institution, but also because it's just given me a whole extra set of conversations that I could open up. So when I used to be in a history department, I was one of four historians there who specialized in the 16th century. And so I really had to kind of fight to carve out my own little space. In the theology and religion department in Durham, I mean, there are a couple of other historians there, but basically I can afford to spread out a little bit. Mm-hmm. And so writing a book like the one that we're going to be talking about today, which has a longer sweep, has been possible. So I started out as a historian of the Reformation. Mm-hmm. And that's still my home patch. I wrote my PhD, 21, 22 years ago now, on the early Reformation in England. And I've gone on to work on English and Scottish topics and ranged a bit further. But you know, over the last few years, I've been able to kind of to work on a broader canvas, which is, I mean, whether it's convincing to anybody, it's been fun for me. And I wrote a book in 2017 trying to tell the story of Protestant Christianity from Martin Luther in the beginning. You've done your homework. That's great. And trying to tell that as a global story and bring it up to the present, because I thought there were some themes running through that story that only really came out when you looked at it in long perspective. And one of those themes that, as I worked on this and on some other stuff, just came to seem more and more important to me was the relationship between Protestant Christianity and the growth of the phenomenon which we could call secularism or atheism or unbelief. Or we can argue about what word you use for that thing or that non thing. And that also came to seem like a big, important story to try to tell. And my 2019 book was my attempt to do that.
Okay, that's excellent. And that's what we're here to talk about, essentially. So, now, in your book, you say that you're a licensed Anglican lay preacher, correct?
That's correct.
So I would be curious to know how your faith might inform your scholarship and whether your scholarship has influenced your faith in any way, possibly.
Well, sure. I'm one human being, and as much as there might be a kind of inclination to try and keep these things separate, you can't, and I'm really suspicious of people who claim that they can. One reason why I make a point of saying that when it's relevant, and each of my last couple of books, I've just kind of put in a note somewhere to that effect, because I think it's important that people know where I'm coming from, and have some sense of what my priors here might be. But your question was, how do my faith and my scholarship affect each other? Well, yes. The simple answer is, yeah, they do. Mm-hmm. How they do that, I'm not sure that I can really answer that question, because I'm probably too close to see it. I mean, clearly the reason that I am so interested in the history of Christianity is because I've got a stake in it. You know, it's I'm not doing paleontology here. Mm-hmm. This is something where, you know, I'm implicated myself, and it matters to me. My sense is that when people bring their own faith to bear on historical scholarship, mm-hmm. you know, it can be done well or it can be done badly.
Right.
And I mean, the ways it can be done badly are kind of obvious when you're mm-hmm. when you're just banging the drum for your own side or whatever. The way it can be done well, and you know, I think I could talk about some of the historians who I think have done this well, is, you know, when they're not using this to try to make a case for, you know, why their community is right and everybody else is wrong, but when you're able to use your own experience mm-hmm. and the experiences of the faith communities that you've been a part of to give you some insight into the religious experiences of people in the past, without falling into the trap of assuming that because we sign up to many of the same beliefs, we are the same, because we're really not. You know, the differences between ourselves and our forebears a few centuries back are profound. You know, I have much, much more in common with, you know, people in my own day and age with different religious beliefs than I do with, you know, other members of the Church of England in the 16th century. But there are some points of commonality, and you can use those carefully to give you a little bit of insight into what's going on. I mean, my hope as a historian has really always been to try to put myself and to put my readers into the shoes of people in the past, to get them to look at the world through those people's eyes. You know, even if those people are acting or thinking in ways that seem to us bizarre or even monstrous, I think it's worth the effort, maybe especially in those circumstances, it's worth the effort to try to understand why they did and thought what they did, which doesn't mean that you need to agree with them. And it doesn't necessarily even mean that you need to forgive them. But I do think it's important that we understand them. Otherwise, it's so easy to just be condescending about people, just because they're dead and can't argue for themselves, and we can easily assume, well, it's so obvious that we're right about everything and they're wrong. Mm-hmm. I my hope is to try to treat our dead and gone forebears with a little bit more respect.
Right. Okay, that's fair enough. I would agree with that. So my last question, the last question I would like to ask before we begin discussing the book itself is if it's okay, could you perhaps tell us a bit about your faith journey?
Sure. That's a story you can tell in a bunch of different ways, but let's do it. I'm a historian, so let's do the straight chronology. I was brought up as from a family with a long background in Scottish Presbyterianism. But my father, who died 9 years ago, almost 9 years ago, was a pretty firm atheist. He embraced that as a young adult. My mother, I think, is more of, you know, who's still with us very much, is still more of an agnostic. But so I had really no kind of religious upbringing.
Okay.
But I do remember my father firmly telling me that, you know, whatever I thought about, you know, is there a God, he said, you come to whatever conclusion you want to, but you have to understand that's a really important question. It isn't something that you can just kind of shrug off and ignore. And I think even though in the end I came to the opposite conclusion from him on that, you know, on that question. I think on that sort of deep point about the fundamental importance of that question, we always agreed. Mm. I had what I now know to be a kind of almost boringly stereotypical Christian conversion experience when I was 18. All I can say was that it didn't seem boring or stereotypical to me at the time.
Okay.
It was a dramatic sense at a moment of particular kind of emotional fluidity mm-hmm. for me. It seemed to click a whole load of things into place.
Mm-hmm.
And especially, and maybe this fits with the way that I'm still talking about the subject, was a moment of understanding that a merely intellectualized and a thinly rationalistic approach to metaphysical questions was not adequate.
Right. It's your book, yeah.
And that a more kind of holistic, intuitive way of reading it mattered. And I then went to university, fell in with a kind of fairly standard student evangelicalism for a while, as many people involved in fairly standard student evangelicalism did, kind of graduated out of that. The Church of England, which is a kind of very strange entity, does have some merits, and one of which is a very inclusive.
Okay.
It's very, very broad. It doesn't have much in the way of universally shared orthodoxies. There's space for an awful lot of different kinds of and approaches to mm-hmm. Christianity within. I mean, within certain pretty broad limits. And so it's quite a kind of safe walled garden within which to explore some of the different possibilities, mm-hmm. Theological possibilities that there are. I at one stage was looking at when I was a student was looking at ordained ministry until a very wise group of selection trainers advised me that probably wasn't the best the best path for me. I daily give thanks for their perception, but out of that process I ended up being licensed as what we call a reader, okay. which is essentially a lay preacher, I was licensed as a reader in 1997, and have been practicing in ministering in my local parish church, wherever that has been, ever since then. I'm currently hold a license from the Bishop of Newcastle in the northeast of England and work in my local parish church here.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for that. That was interesting to hear. So now, my first question about the book would be, in the beginning of your book, you disagree or you find fault with what you call the death by philosophy narrative of secularization. And you,
that's right.
So can you explain what this view advocates and why you find it problematic?
Sure. I'm conscious that this is a little bit of a caricature, but I'm going to caricature it, deal with it. There's a standard view of the history of atheism, and I think this off often would frame itself as the kind of history of atheism, which is about almost a kind of heroic struggle led by a series of big name thinkers, which starts with, and these thinkers are philosophers and scientists, basically. So it's a story with folks like Spinoza and then Pierre Bayle, and Hume and Voltaire and Tom Paine. And then once you get into the 19th century, that's kind of coming more out into the open, and you've got Schopenhauer and Marx and Charles Darwin, who's kind of a slightly odd fit in that story because his own religious situation is more complicated than has been taken on by many of the people who want to claim his mantle later. This is the story that basically says, you know, once there was an age of faith, and then along came a series of brilliant free thinkers who were unfettered by the constraints that orthodoxy and churches, or synagogues indeed in some cases, placed on their on their minds, were able to freely inquire and turn around and say, hang on a second, they're telling us about a God, but there's no evidence that there is any such entity. And all these scientists are demonstrating that all the scientific questions, the questions about the natural world that we used to answer by saying God did it, in fact, we've now got perfectly good scientific explanations of them. And so you end up in the situation that Pierre Laplace that did with Napoleon. I mean, this is kind of an apocryphal story, but yeah, it kind of captures it. At the beginning of the 19th century, when he produces this astronomical textbook, and Napoleon asks, "Well, why haven't you put anything about God in it?" And Laplace says, "I have no need of that hypothesis. You know, that it's possible to explain the world without reference to God." And therefore, this double-sided attack from the scientists making God as an explanatory force redundant, and the philosophers undercutting the metaphysical case for theism converge on this point by the late 19th century, of which it becomes, on this view, not just possible but kind of almost necessary to declare that the religion is a spent force. And this famously leads Nietzsche to say that, you know, God is dead and we have killed him. Which, you know, as a story about the history of ideas, if you want to take it narrowly at that level, it sort of works. Only sort of, because as most of those thinkers would say, certainly on the philosophical side, none of these are new ideas. Most of this is stuff that goes back to the ancient world. And even on the scientific side, quite a lot of it goes back to the ancient world. And the reason I really have problems with this is that it does not match the actual history of secularization, of the ebbing and flowing, I mean mostly ebbing over the past couple of centuries, but not all, of Christianity in the West. And this is very much a specifically Western Christian story with kind of supporting role played by Judaism. One of the things that I think is going on here is that we've tended to think of secularization as this kind of universal force sweeping the world. Mm-hmm. And, well, I just think, look around the world today, and it doesn't look like that to me. This is a local story, almost a parochial one. It's a North Atlantic story about the Europe, North America, and a handful of other mostly settler societies around the world that have been dominated by people who've sort of taken on board that kind of cultural framing. Obviously, there's secularism in other parts of the world, right. But you know, North American secularism and say Turkish secularism or Indian secularism or Chinese secularism are all very different from each other. And so it's specifically the Western variant that I'm interested in. And I just do not think the evidence is there to allow you to trace that connection between the philosophers and the scientists and the widespread social phenomenon of the erosion of religious belief and belonging. And my suggestion, and I can talk about how why I got to thinking this in the first place in a minute if you like, is that we've actually got this backwards. That we have tended to think, okay, so some philosophers came up with some ideas and therefore people stopped believing.
Right.
And my suspicion is that in fact belief as a social, as a lived phenomenon started to erode, and that the philosophers then started coming along to come up with explanations for this. Because you know, anybody who needs a philosophy badly enough is gonna find one sooner or later. And you know, the ideas were already out there. They were there in the ancient world and you know, easy enough to come up with. What's really striking is the way that you find people who, you know, are taking the kinds of questions about, you know, the being of God or the immortality of the soul or whatever else that theologians and philosophers had talked about for centuries and had kind of been willing to dismiss, and suddenly these old ideas start to seem compelling to people. And that's why I thought this isn't really a story about the history of ideas. It's a story about the history of emotions. And that's the framing for the account that I was trying to tell.
Okay. So that was helpful. So you also, and in your book, you also say that you don't mean to diminish or denigrate the emotions as irrational per se. So how would you then characterize the relationship between the emotions and the intellect, or the head and the heart, if you prefer to put it that way?
Thank you for asking that, and especially thank you for posing that head heart thing, because you know, and forgive me if I go on a bit of a rant about this, because that sense of the head and the heart as being opposed to each other, I think is a really deep-seated error in the way that we think about human nature. And I don't think it's any coincidence that this is a division that really first starts to appear in Western thought in the sort of later, you know, second half of the 17th century. You first find people talking about it in those terms, and it's become really entrenched. Before then, the heart was sometimes spoken of as the seat of the will, and obviously there was more of the development of medical science has given us more of a sense of the, you know, the particular function of the brain, which there was real debate about in pre-modern anatomy. But the suggestion that the emotions are somehow separate from or opposite to the intellect, I mean, seems to me just kind of self-evidently false and baseless. So when I talk about an emotional history, I do not mean something that is irrational or sub-rational. Our emotions are very rational. In that, you know, we usually, whatever our emotions might be, there's always a good reason for it. But they are more than merely rational. You know, we're not calculating machines on legs. Pascal yes. who's one of the people who I
I was going to get to.
I keep going back to in this, talks about the difference between the mathematical and the intuitive. And this is coming from somebody who's one of the greatest mathematicians of his age, so he is not against mathematics. But his argument, and I think this still basically holds, is that there are some truths that you cannot perceive, that you cannot reason your way into. I mean, the example that he poses is, how do you know that you're not dreaming
right
now? And of course, ultimately, the answer is that you don't. And that, you know, I'm sure many of us, I certainly have had the experience of, you know, being in a dream and wondering whether you're dreaming and concluding that you're not, because, you know, somehow you know you're not. And so the blankly rationalist answer to that is to say, well, in that case, you can't know whether you're dreaming, because, you know, it's impossible to prove it. And yet we kind of do, don't we? We do actually kind of function in that conviction. And so Pascal's view is to say, well, okay, if your mathematical mind, if that kind of reason is understood in that sense, is unable to discern this truth that you are awake right now, that does not show that truth is inaccessible. It shows the weakness, the limits of that kind of reason, and the need to transcend it. And this kind of goes back to an older definition of what reason is. Nowadays we think of reason, rationality as the process of logic. It's a method. It's a way that you think. Which is fine. I don't think anybody has a problem with that. But if you were to go back to the medieval philosophers on this, they would say that reason is actually is almost like a sense. It's a power of perception. The example, again, I mean, it's not unlike the how do you know you're awake question, is, you know, how do you know that 1 + 1 = 2? And if you're Bertrand Russell, deep in the kind of rationalistic frame of modernism, then you end up writing a vast Principia Mathematica attempting to prove precisely that 1 + 1 = 2. And, you know, then later in your life, concluding that you hadn't done it right. That's a formidably difficult question if you approach it in that, you know, highly analytic way. The medieval philosophers would have said, well, it's just obvious. And the fact that you can't argue for it shows that this is something that you have to intuit, rather than, you know, you're basically either you see it or you don't. Mm-hmm. And if you don't, then there's no arguing. Mm-hmm. So, and that's the sense in which reason is, in this wider sense, a power of perception, your ability to grasp something when it seems, you know, as we say, intuitively obvious to you. The subtitle of the book is An Emotional History of Doubt. Maybe I should have called it An Intuitive History of Doubt. But I use emotion as a framing because I do think that it's emotional explanations for the experience of both belief and unbelief, mm-hmm. which we need to use if we're going to give them satisfaction. Mm-hmm. I talk about anxiety and anger as the two main emotional drivers of the story of unbelief that I wanted to mm-hmm. tell. But I mean, I think we're all kind of familiar with, I think we sort of mostly accept that if you're going to give an account of somebody's religious beliefs, of somebody who is actually a believer, that needs to be a story that's emotional and intuitive, as, you know, if just to give a historical account of how somebody comes to believe and to retain their beliefs, it has to be told in those terms. And I'm just trying to do the same thing for unbelief, which is not to try to say that atheists or unbelievers are irrational. It's just trying to say that they're human, and that's how human beings work. We are, our reason, our rationality in that kind of narrow calculating sense is contained within this kind of wider penumbra of who we are and what seems self-evidently true to us.
Yes. Okay. Thank you for clarifying that. And I'm glad that you mentioned Pascal, because you anticipated my next question, which is you call Pascal, I think, the shrewdest, the 17th century's shrewdest wrestler with doubt.
Yeah. I mean, if you want to come back at me with you know, somebody else from the 17th century to put against him, you know, we could argue that back and forth. But yeah, I'll stick with that.
Okay, so why do you think he deserves that? Okay, maybe he's not the best, but like, we can set that aside. But why do you think he is at least a very shrewd wrestler with doubt?
Because I mean, Pascal, we know about his work on this from these fragments that he leaves. He spent much of the last few years of his life trying to write a treatise against atheism, and he drew up loads of notes for it, but was having trouble organizing them. And I mean, my suspicion is that actually the book that he was trying to write was unwritable. But in any case, these fragments are then pulled together by his executors and published on just under the most bland title possible, Pensées, Thoughts, after his death. I mean, what I find so compelling about his approach to this is, you know, he's a Catholic, although a rather unorthodox Catholic, a Catholic within the tradition called Jansenism, which, you know, draws on a certain kind of strong Augustinianism, which has at least a nodding acquaintance with the approach that Calvinism takes and ends up being condemned within the Catholic Church. So he's a Catholic, but not exactly a straight down the line one. And has very much worked through the kind of great wrestlers with doubt of the previous century, especially. And I mean, he's constantly in dialogue with his French predecessor from nearly a century earlier, Michel de Montaigne, the great essayist, who, I mean, Montaigne is one of the great prophets of doubt. Rediscovers, because, like I said, all this comes from the ancient world. He rediscovers the notion of philosophical skepticism. The doctrine that no certain knowledge of anything can be had, and which leads him not just to doubt what he's told authoritatively by whatever source might be telling him, trying to tell him things authoritatively, but also to doubt his own reason. You know, Montaigne is very, you know, very clear on the unreliability of our own thoughts. You know, he says something, you know, you know, no two people ever quite think the same thing, and even one person never thinks quite the same thing at any two times. You know, everything is always fluid. There's no certainty to be had of any kind. And Montaigne, having you know, sawed off the branch that he himself is sitting on, and in fact destroyed the possibility of any firm footing anywhere, then turns around and says, well, in that case, since I can't be certain of anything at all, my only option left is to embrace the Catholic faith, because that's given to me from outside. I don't, my reason may tell me that it's problematic, but I know now not to believe my reason. Because it's unlikely to be, you know, it's just as unreliable as anything else. But here is this external certainty, you know, the Catholic faith that's been preached in France for 1,000 years, you know, and I'm just going to embrace that. It's almost a kind of existentialist move, a kind of decision of the will or submission to the will. And for Pascal, that won't do. And he's a huge admirer. Well, and he's always disagreeing with Montaigne, but he can't stop quoting. Mm-hmm. So you know, there's this kind of strange quarrelsome closeness between them. His approach is to say, you know, yeah, this is true. There is no certainty to be had with your rational mind. The rational mind is a broken reed. But he also recognizes that the kind of Hail Mary pass of saying, well, no, I'm just going to decide to believe in the Catholic Church and that's the end of it. You know, that just bypasses the question of uncertainty. It doesn't actually resolve it. But Pascal is also somebody who has had these extraordinarily intense emotional experiences. As you know, it feels really reductive to call it that, but no. He famously at his death is found with kind of sewn into his coat this account of an experience which, you know, he dates precisely, and you know, can only describe using the word fire, in which he encounters, as he says, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, not the God of the philosophers. And so one of the things that he says repeatedly in these pensées is there is no point trying to argue about the being or the non-being of God. Is there a God? It's the intuitive mind. Again, either you see it or you don't. And if you see it, then nothing will, in the end, will be able to persuade you not to. And if you don't, then nothing can open your eyes. It's like having an argument about whether there's a sun in the sky. You know, if you look up and see it, then there's no point continuing with the argument. If you look up and don't, then, you know, again, there's no point. And so, you know, he spends a lot of time talking around this, but that a lot of what he keeps coming back to is trying to persuade people that's how the land lies, that it does have to be as profound as that. And he has a great deal of sympathy for people who struggle to believe but can't do so. The people who he professes to be completely baffled by, and I must say, I believe he sounds genuinely bewildered and incomprehending about this, are the people who profess that they don't care. Who could say, "Ah, God, does it matter?" You know, he finds this utterly incomprehensible, and he famously comes up with this challenge of the wager that's become such a famous part of the history of philosophy, which I think has been misunderstood. But anyway, sorry, you were about to ask something else.
I was just going to say that I remember the passage where he says the same thing, that he says that he's baffled by people who are indifferent towards what he calls the immortality of the soul and as well, mm-hmm. and not just God. So thank you for your insightful comments once again. And now I would like to maybe discuss a bit the scope of your study. So You focus disproportionately on the Protestant world in England in particular. So, why did you decide to do so?
Okay, well, I mean, I'm glad we had a chance to talk about Pascal and Montaigne a bit, so that people can get the sense that it's not purely an English and Protestant based study. Okay, well, there are two reasons for my having done that. One of them more respectable than the other. The less respectable one is this is just what I know. This is the field in which I've got the most experience. I know the sources there. They're pretty well. And it was through encountering some people who I didn't expect to be talking about atheism and unbelief in sources in early 17th century England that first made me think, wait a second, there's a story to be told here. So in that sense, it's just where I happened to pick up the trail. And I suspect you could tell a similar story based on a different run of sources from elsewhere. Having said that, I do think, and this would be my second, my more respectable reason, I do think there's a good reason why the Protestant story in general and the English, well, England stroke New England story in particular is at the kind of leading edge of this. The Protestant story, I think, is particularly crucial because what the Protestant Reformation does is weaponize skepticism as a tool of religious controversy. That the argument between between Catholics and Protestants as it plays out in the across the course of the 16th century is very much from the Protestant side a matter of picking out a string of Catholic doctrines and not just arguing that these are untrue but mocking as untrue. Skepticism becomes a really fundamental part of the Protestant assault and of Protestant identity. And to some extent, it requires Catholics to then take on the same position in return. But I think it's fair to say that the Protestants start that. And there is this kind of long-standing point, which I think is quite insightful, that, if there is this if true Christianity has often tried to see itself as a kind of a sort of virtuous middle between impiety and superstition, that Catholicism leans more towards superstition and Protestantism leans more towards impiety. So I think in that sense, Protestantism helps to kind of turbocharge the skeptical process. So that applies generally to Protestants. The English story is of particular importance within that because of all of the Calvinist churches, the churches within the Reformed Protestant world, England stands out as the only one that never puts in place a proper collective disciplinary structure. If you're a Calvinist in France, probably comes minority there, or in the Netherlands or Switzerland or Scotland or Hungary, or indeed in large parts of the American colonies, then there is a consistory or a Kirk session or some kind of church body, a church meeting that is responsible for maintaining discipline and deciding who is a member of the church in good standing and who isn't. The English church is never able to set that up. Some churchmen would like to, but the government won't let them because it looks too much like an independent entity that can then turn its fire on the government itself, as indeed happened in some places. And the result of that is that process of discipline in England gets internalized. People have to do it for themselves. And so rather than having an outside agency which is able to say, yeah, you're fine, you're doing just great, relax, this is enough. If you're somebody who really takes your faith earnestly, it's never enough. There's no one who can authoritatively tell you it's good enough. And I mean, this is pretty widely known. It leads to the kind of acceleration of the movement that we call Puritanism. The way it's kind of endlessly pursuing a kind of unattainable perfection. And my argument is that pursuit in particular leads to this skepticism that had been weaponized by the Protestants early on, being turned in against themselves.
Yes.
And in particular, I think there's a question about the way that the religious anxieties mm-hmm. that this produces can kind of go septic on people, and lead them to a constant process of self-examination and questioning, which could actually end up being, you know, really corrosive to religious orthodoxy. Sorry, that was a really long-winded answer. No,
that's fine. That was very helpful. But I mean,
you may have gathered, I would have liked to have been able to do more in terms of other stories than this, but I do think there's something particular about the English story. I begin the book with John Bunyan, over Pilgrim's Progress, as you may have seen, and you know, obviously Bunyan, very important book within sort of modern Christian culture, but you know, he is somebody who talks about exactly this sort of internal wrestling with profound doubts, yeah. And it's that story that I really want to see as much more central to this recognized.
Mm-hmm. So you anticipated another one of my questions, because I wanted to ask you about the role, or the alleged role of the Protestant Reformation in the history of secularization, because in the second chapter of your book, you write, and I quote, "There is a well-established view that the credit or blame for modern unbelief lies with the Protestant Reformation, a view most recently laid out in Brad Gregory's 2012 book, The Unintended Reformation," end quote. So you mentioned that the Protestant Reformation gave rise to or weaponized skepticism. So, and it also caused some anxiety. So apart from those two considerations, what is your just general assessment of this view that Protestantism led to secularization in the West?
Well, I mean, yeah, I think I've basically summarized my view of how I think this happened, that Protestantism is able to distill out some of these themes of doubt that had long been pervasive and kind of concentrate them. The way it uses skepticism helps to bring them to the surface. It produces these kind of intense religious anxieties, and I mean, my other theme of anger is pretty obviously there in the way that that these religious disputes develop. The book was written partly in kind of dialogue with, well, it's loose dialogue with Brad Gregory's The Unintended Reformation that you mentioned. And I mean, Brad and I have argued over this sort of thing, and you know, I think I think his argument is close enough to the truth to be seriously misleading, is how I would put it. and I mean, he might well be even less polite about mine. But I think the difference is that he's representing a tradition that would see secularism as a kind of a consequence of the futility and exhaustion of the Reformation era conflicts, that you've got a couple of certainties kind of knocking seven bells out of each other, unable to do more than fight it to an armed truce. And so in the end, you know, 18th century society, you know, pretty much decides that you know, religious conflict is just too dangerous to be allowed to continue anymore. They're going to bypass it. Mm-hmm. The philosophers have just run into a brick wall. Like, nobody can prove anything. And so, hey, you know, let's go shopping.
Yes.
And so in that sense, I mean, and this is why he calls it the unintended Reformation. Mm-hmm. That on this view, you've got two very non-secular movements, mm-hmm. whose clash produces, you know, they end up kind of reducing each other to rubble, with the result that, you know, the civilians caught up in the crossfire start asking themselves, well, what if they're all wrong?
Mm-hmm.
Or this is just too crazy, let's leave it to one side and do something else. And I don't think that the atheists are just the kind of the battlefield medics and the architects of post-war reconstruction. I think they're the combatants.
Okay.
I think that the way in which the battle itself is fought means that these strands of unbelief come right out of the center of these religious traditions.
Mm-hmm.
And now, I mean, you might think, okay, that's a kind of real hair-splitting difference. But I think it matters, and this is why I think it matters, because that it means essentially that modern secularism, modern unbelief, is not as irreligious as it thinks it is.
Okay.
Because, I mean, in particular, what the thing that I really see driving that combination of anger and anxiety, and what brings those two themes together and makes them such a powerful combination, is when they acquire moral force and are able to start articulating an ethical critique of Christian orthodoxy.
Mm-hmm.
Both, you know, on the anxiety side, trying to rebase Christian orthodoxy on a sense of what true morals are, and to see that as the core of what your religion should be. And on the anger side, obviously, you know, the very easy and very powerful critique of churches on all sides of their failure to live up to what ought to be their own their own moral position. So, I mean, the way that I would bring that story forward into the modern era and look at the spectacular collapse in open affiliation to religious communities over the past half century or so, is not to do with any kind of philosophical or scientific breakthrough, because that plainly has not happened within that time frame. You know, all the scientific arguments about atheism are basically the same as they were a century ago, or indeed they're weaker than they were then. But the change in our moral framework is profound. And you know, what makes modern humanism so effective is not that it can explain where stars come from, but that it's able to give meaning to human life by providing a moral framework that we find compelling. Of course, that moral framework is still, you know, a kind of deracinated version of Christianity or of Judeo-Christianity. It's human rights and all that is based on a set of Christian or post-Christian values, and the validity of that system of belief of the worth of human rights, again, is one of those, you know, intuitive mind things. It's really hard to prove the existence of human rights from first principles. You just have to see it. You know, as Jefferson said, you know, we hold these truths to be self-evident. In other words, he couldn't prove it. He just has to say, it seems obvious to me. And of course it seems obvious to me. I'm a creature of the modern world. It seems obvious to me too, but I can't prove it. And so in that sense, I think the fact that we're living within a secularism which has arisen directly out of these Christian movements shows that it's both less stable and also less secular. Mm-hmm. Than we like to think. That does not mean I think it's about to re-erupt into Orthodox Christianity. I really don't think that's going to happen. Mm-hmm. But it does mean that I think whichever direction it does go in next is a lot less predictable than the kind of comfortable prophets of secularization might like to believe.
Mm-hmm. And so relating to, morality, we could say, towards the end of your book, you talk about how our unmistakable standard of morality used to be the person of Christ, but now it has become Hitler. So I think you also write that Hitler has now become a more potent moral figure than Christ himself. So could you perhaps elaborate on that?
Sure. I mean, when I say there's become a more potent moral figure, I think if you were to go back a century or so, then Jesus Christ was the most powerful moral figure within Western culture, in the sense that he's the person from whom people took their moral bearings. Mm-hmm. Obviously, Christian believers did, but if you look at a very wide range of atheists and skeptics from that era as well, they will go out of their way to say, you know, Jesus was the greatest moral teacher, in human history, and indeed will very often use the figure of Jesus to critique institutional Christianity, which is again kind of an open goal sometimes. And nobody would have mocked or disparaged Jesus as an emotional figure at that, as a moral figure at that point, unless you wanted to kind of out yourself as a monster. Mm-hmm. Nietzsche does do this, and as a result, gets treated as a monster. It just does not seem to me that Jesus as a figure has anything like that kind of salience or purchase within our culture. But the figure who does have that kind of salience or purchase is Adolf Hitler and the Nazi movement more generally, who is, or at least until very recently has been, I do think this is breaking down, but the fixed reference point, the one by whom we define what morality is. Of course, a negative exemplar rather than a positive. But nevertheless, you know, we now, you know, define what evil is with reference to Nazism. There's a reason why Godwin's law famously says that any argument on the internet goes on until somebody calls somebody else a Nazi, and at that point it finishes, because once that's happened, there's nothing more to say. It is almost literally like accusing somebody of being the Antichrist. It is the ultimate insult. The swastika has become the most powerful visual symbol in our culture. I mean, you can mess around with crucifixes, and artists do this all the time. You would be very foolish as a modern artist to try to do something clever and ironic with a swastika. In Britain we had for many years the former mayor of London, Ken Livingstone, who made a long career as an iconoclastic politician of the kind who can say anything and not get into trouble, you know, the species. Mm-hmm. Until one day he made a series of remarks about, you know, oh well, Hitler wasn't so bad and was misunderstood, and it killed his political career dead in a day. You know, he was ostracized to an extent that he clearly found headspin. You might be able to shoot somebody in the middle of Fifth Avenue, but there are some things you can't do. I think that's really interesting and telling about our culture. These are we say that we've become this sort of very secular and very pluralistic culture with no shared points of reference. Yeah. I think we've got a little bit more in the way of shared points of reference than we generally recognize. and that secular moral structure based around this, you know, figure from recent history, who is not a religious figure, rather than the religious framing that taking Jesus as our authority point gives us, is, I think that's quite a compelling sign of the nature of modern secularism.
Okay, so thank you very much for that. And just before we conclude this interview, could you perhaps tell us about any projects you might be working on at the moment? And do you expect to write another book in the near future?
Sure. No, thanks for asking. I mean, I brought a short book on the English Reformation out last year. But my main research project at the moment is about the early history of the missionary movement in Christianity. I think there's an untold story about the beginnings of Protestant missions. Okay. We tend to see this as something that started in the 1790s or thereabouts, maybe with a few earlier. I think there's quite a lot more going on before that. So the sort of early history of the globalization of this kind of tradition. Mm-hmm. I set out to do this with a kind of trying to write I'll write something short about why there wasn't an early Protestant missionary movement. I thought, well, because I'm writing about something that's not there, it won't take very long. It turns out there's a lot more there than I had thought. And so this process is taking me longer and becoming more involved than I'd imagined. And it's also deeply tied up with the early history of imperialism and of the slave trade. Mm-hmm. So this is a complicated, tangled, and in many places pretty ugly story. But not exclusively ugly. There's all sorts of strange and interesting things going on. So I'm deep in this right now, it's going to be a couple of years, but I hope I'll have something coming out soon.
Okay, all right. Well, thank you very much for your time, Professor Ryrie. It's been fascinating talking to you.
Okay, you too.